That is U2 and Pride on BBC Radio Oxford. I'm Will Gompertz, and I'm delighted to say in the studio is Ian Golden, who is the Professor of Globalisation and Development at Oxford University, at very specifically the Oxford Martin School, which you run. For those of us who can get no further than Balliol and All Souls, what is the Oxford Martin School?
The Oxford Martin School is a start-up in Oxford. We've been going close on 10 years now. Mm. We were founded by the biggest ever benefaction by someone called James Martin to Oxford. And our aim is to address the biggest 21st century challenges by bringing teams together from across the university. So we work with 60 different disciplines. We have about 300 people in teams focusing on things from neuroscience to climate change, to inequality, across the board, very interdisciplinary, very, very innovative, and very exciting, I think.
You've got a remarkable background, Ian. I mean, you were vice president of the World Bank, the bank's director of development policy. These are big, big jobs. And then, following the end of apartheid, you became the economic advisor to President Mandela, because you are South African, right?
It's quite a
hinterland.
It was a dream come true. I thought I would never go back to South Africa in my lifetime. I was in exile, living in the UK and France. And then South Africa transformed, and this extraordinary opportunity to be able to serve in Nelson Mandela's government arose, and I went back to be his economic advisor and run the state bank.
How did that arise, Ian? I mean, did you literally get a call from the great man?
Well, it's part of what I discuss in Age of Discovery and the Pursuit of Development, how these systemic changes in the world lead to cascading events. So this, I really feel now, in retrospect, was something that came out of the end of the Cold War. The end of apartheid clearly was facilitated by that. There'd been a massive struggle over a long period of time, so it was a catalytic factor,
yes,
rather than causal. And President Mandela came to Paris very soon after he was freed. I was living there at the time, working at the OECD.
Did you know him from the old days?
I'd been involved. No, well, he'd been in prison for 27 years.
Yeah.
So I was barely 27 at the time. Uh-huh. I had the privilege to have dinner with him in Paris, and he asked me to be the economic advisor. I'd been working with the ANC on its economic policies. And then in 94, when South Africa became democratic, I went back. And in 95, he offered me the job to be the chief executive of the Development Bank of Southern Africa. And then I was very involved in the government for 5 years before I left again to the World Bank. And then, I was at the World Bank for 6 years, and then I came to Oxford in 2006.
An amazing, amazing life. And let's talk about it a bit within the context of these two books you've brought in. One's published by Bloomsbury, and it's called The Age of Discovery, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance. And I completely agree, there is a new renaissance in a slightly different shape and form. And then you have another book, smaller book called The Pursuit of Development, Economic Growth, Social Change and Ideas, both of which are about how, I suppose they play to the Oxford Martin School agenda of what are the big problems of this age, what can we learn from the past, and how can we take advantage of our situation and not make a complete horlicks of it. That's broadly speaking where we're at, isn't it?
Well, I think you've summarised it beautifully, much more succinctly than I could.
But going back to this moment you had with Mandela, because what's always struck me about that extraordinary occurrence in sort of the history of humanity was his attitude. That he could have come out all guns blazing, he could have been furious, he could have been violent, he could have been aggressive. He was none of those. He came out almost, he came out with this extraordinary spirituality, which made everybody able to rally behind him and follow him. And that was just the most extraordinary example of leadership, wasn't it? And that, if the world now is about anything, it's about having great leaders.
I think that's absolutely right. I've been fortunate to meet many leaders, but no one is in the same league as President Mandela was. He was quite extraordinary, not only in his forgiveness and not harping on his past, never on himself, in fact, in any dimension, but also forward-looking and thinking all the time about what was best for the country, South Africa, and particularly what was best for poor people, for people that had been victims of apartheid for so many generations. Much, much bigger than anyone else I knew in his attitude and in his capacity, and also remarkably much more humble. He was really interested in individuals and their lives. He was always interested in how my kids were, how they were adjusting to the change of coming back. And that was always the conversation he wanted to start with before we'd get into something really heavy, like, should we nationalize the mines?
and if all the problems that you are looking at in the Martin School, from neuroscience to globalization to mass migration to global warming, all these big issues which we're facing today, if you could say, I want to clone Nelson Mandela and have him run each one of those areas, is that what you do? I mean, what I'm saying is, it all really about leadership?
I think leadership is extremely important, but clearly it's about many other things too. Firstly, we need to understand what's going on. So it's about science, it's about knowledge, it's about learning, it's about listening. And that's what Mandela also was absolutely brilliant at. I mean, Mandela had been in prison a long time. He was a lawyer. Yeah. He didn't understand a whole range of things, including economic policy issues when he came out, which I was involved in. And the first thing he did was learn. I mean, he would spend days and days and days and days learning before he said anything, and just probing and probing. Never being embarrassed to admit his own complete lack of knowledge. And of course, when we're dealing with these incredibly complex questions, that's what you have to do. You really have to understand what's going on first from a very wide variety of perspectives. It's not just the pure physical, but it's the ethical, it's the economic, it's so many. And then, yes, you need to make decisions and you need to bring people along with you and you need to think about who's going to be impacted on them. So you need to think about who you're trying to protect, whose lives you're trying to advance. And the great tragedy, I think, of this time, which I discuss in both of these times, but it's the focus of Asia Discovery, is that we have this extraordinary advance in society.
Yeah.
In our life expectancies are greater. We've conquered so many of the things that our parents and grandparents had to deal with, and yet we feel so insecure and many people are worse off. That is about the decisions that are being made by political leaders and their failures at the national and global level to really deal and share these advances.
Which is interesting to set that conversation up in such a way. And we're going to have a song from Joan Armour Trading, after which we're going to sort out all the world's problems in the next 10 minutes.
We're going to have a great rest of the day.
Yeah. Good stuff. I am not in love. That is Joan Armour Trading in Love and Affection on BBC Radio Oxford. I'm in the studio with Ian Golden, Professor Ian Golden, who is director of the Oxford Martin School, which is set up to tackle all the world's major problems and try and come up with solutions. He's written a book. We've written two books, but I'm going to just focus on one right now, which is called The Age of Discovery, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance. It's been unbelievably well reviewed by people who are very well known indeed. A powerful journey. This book will help the world, says Sir Richard Branson. Everyone should read it, says Michael Spence. I think there's loads of them, other people you might have heard of. A hugely stimulating book. Everyone should heed the author's call. That's from Niall Ferguson, Professor of History at Harvard University. And on it goes. So congratulations on that. It came
Thank
out on
will.
Thursday. Ian, there's two things, I suppose, I'd like to discuss about this. There's the subtitle, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance. What is common between the Renaissance of the 15th and 16th century and now, and what can we learn? And secondly, the argument you make that if you were ever to be reborn at any time in the whole history of humanity, it would be to be reborn in 2016. But let's deal with Renaissance. What can we learn, or what is similar about what went on in Italy, let's say, principally, in the 15th and 16th century, and what's going on in the world in the 21st century?
Yeah. I believe we're living in a new Renaissance. It's been going, I think, since about the time the Berlin Wall fell down, which was the same year the internet was invented.
1989, 1990.
And this is really an information revolution. It's about how ideas are traveling, not how quickly people absorb ideas. In other words, how quickly they discard old ideas and take on new ideas, and how this leads to a new ability to gain perspective, how it leads to breakthroughs in the arts, in culture, in everything, and of course in the sciences, and how it also leads to new yearning for learning, literacy. There are 3 billion more literate people in the world today than they were when the wall came down.
And is that driven through the economic developments of China and India?
It's partly economic, but this is a virtuous circle in which people are becoming literate, girls are becoming educated, people are becoming educated around the world. There are things to read and write, and there are things to contribute, and there are things to learn. And so the world is turned into a giant factory of information, of knowledge, of extraordinary sharing, which is leading to leaps in many, many dimensions. Not just the sciences, but across the board. And that's what happened in the Renaissance. And there the driver was the Gutenberg press. Before that, only monks in Latin, in their monasteries, could really read and write. There was virtually nothing for ordinary people to absorb, and therefore there was very little hunger for literacy. There was nothing to read, and it was expensive. And suddenly you had this revolution, and within years, millions of books, millions more political pamphlets and advertisements and everything else were printed in people's own languages. And this desire to learn and to share took off, and it led to this extraordinary flowering of cultures and all the things that we think of as the iconic achievements of that period, the Michelangelos, Da Vinci's,
but that's all on the credit side.
Yes.
But of course, there is a big debit side.
And that's right. And that's why I found the Renaissance such a powerful period to look back to. There are many, and many will find other periods. So this isn't that somehow, I'm not saying it's the best. I've just found it extremely useful with my co-author, Chris Kutana. And that's because this did not end happily. Mm. This ended in the spread of very bad ideas, people contesting authority dramatically. At that time, you could buy your way to heaven with indulgences in the Catholic Church. Yeah, yeah. The Catholic Church had the monopoly of information and of the way that people understood things, and suddenly there was very strong contesting of that alternative ideas and a real challenge to authority, very rapidly rising inequality. The spread of diseases as well as the spread of good things, some of them were unintended, like that happened to most Native Americans, being killed by the voyagers of discovery.
Absolutely.
So it's this both intended and unintended consequences, and then you had Savonarola taking over with a band of extremists, Florence. You had the bonfire of the vanities, the destruction of this, not anti-modernity, a different vision of modernity.
Yes.
Using the technologies of modernity, the same printing presses. And then, of course, you had the Inquisition's religious wars that spilled over into my college, Balliol, a few years later.
Yeah. And ended up in revolutions across Europe.
And ended up in revolutions. And so when you look at the Renaissance in the long sweep of history, what's remarkable is not only that we celebrated 500 years on as this period of a flowering, but also that it led to very little progress for humanity at the time. And that's what worries me now.
So that's the parallel you draw.
That's the parallel. People are not sharing in this Renaissance. They are not feeling that it's benefiting them. There are groups in society, like if you're born in the Midwest of the US or in parts of England, where you have less chance of escaping poverty than your parents might have.
Because?
Because the wealthy are capturing the benefits, and those that can globalize effectively are capturing the benefits. And if you're in the right place with the right skills at the right time, you can afford a place in London, you can afford good education, you can be mobile, you can park your money in offshore tax havens or whatever if you're a global company, you do incredibly well.
But that's the elite, though, Ian, isn't
it? That's the elite.
I think there is an element of this in your book, isn't there, that everybody benefits from the rising tide to a certain extent.
Yes, most people benefit, not everyone benefits.
Everybody.
And it's also not only whether you're benefiting. Most people's life expectancy has improved. Most people are eating much better food. Most people are consuming much better products and air.
So why is it?
But there is a group in society who are being left behind.
Yes, it's a big fraction.
And there are countries in the world that are being left behind. But it's also a question of relative. Do we feel that the train is racing away from us too rapidly? Do we feel that we're being left behind?
Is this why we're all so anxious?
And that's not only about absolute, it's about relative position. And the final point is that when we connect, wonderful things connect, which will improve and do improve all of our lives, but really scary things connect too.
Yeah.
So a financial crisis that starts in the US cascades around the world. A pandemic that starts somewhere can similarly lead to contagion around the world. Cyber attacks from someone else destroy our computing systems, and the unintended consequences of success. We all climb the energy curve, And we have climate change. We all take antibiotics and we have antibiotics.
So these are all big things which do affect us. But I suppose we've generally feel we don't have much control over them. But why is it just on a day-to-day living experience that the argument you place in your book, which I think is absolutely right, that we all feel more anxious? In fact, we're better off, we're possibly more secure, we're going to live longer, we're more entertained, our brains are able to be stimulated by things which have suddenly become available because of the internet and all the rest of it. Why do we feel more anxious, less happy, and more unsure?
I think the reason we feel more anxious is because the pace of change is accelerating.
So we feel out of control.
The number of surprises that will confront us is growing rapidly. There's uncertainty, and uncertainty leads to anxiety. The upside is enormous, but so is the downside risk, much greater. And it's that sense of imbalance, and we worry about risk. But it's also because we feel, and we write, that our leaders are not in control. They don't understand what's going on. We can no longer trust those that we used to delegate managing societies to. And that's for a number of reasons. One is that we're so much more interconnected. When you're interconnected, you're entangled, you're interdependent. And it's that interdependency that means what happens on the other side of the world will increasingly affect our lives.
So I have to ask you this, just from your point of view, who studied this in such depth, just on the European referendum, are you in, are you out?
I'm absolutely in, because I ask myself the question, what will best safeguard the future of the British people? Will British people be better off by being part of a Europe which is stronger? And it will be stronger if we're in it, because we're in a very effective force in making Europe a better place. And will Britain be stronger by being part of this great bloc? And when I think of the key drivers of change in the world and the key risks facing the future of the British people, whether it's Russia or whether it's climate change or whether it's pandemic or whether it's cyber attacks, as well as the opportunities, how we'll embrace new technologies, how we'll benefit from the growth of Asia and many other things, how we'll benefit from the science of the world. Every question I ask, would we be better off by being in or outside Europe? I'm absolutely convinced we would be better off by being in Europe.
That's a very, very compelling argument for somebody who knows what they're talking about. My final question to you, Ian. I mean, this is like a conference. I could go on for days. It's fascinating. But broadly speaking, when you're looking at the future, and I'm talking about our children's future, not centuries away. Broadly speaking, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
I'm extraordinarily optimistic. And The Pursuit of Development, the other book that came out last week, is really about how much progress we've made, how average life expectancy in the world has improved by about 20 years over the last 40 years. And any of these metrics, except the environmental ones you look at, you have to be optimistic. But I'm optimistic because I believe that this new information, the spreading of ideas, will make us make the right decisions.
So it's going to be a bumpy road.
It's going to be very bumpy. It's going to be like a roller coaster in a wonderful amusement park, steep ups, sharp declines, hair-raising corners, but exhilarating.
Ian Golden, you have been a brilliant guest. Thank you so much. Your two books, Age of Discovery, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance, is out now and published by Bloomsbury. And The Pursuit of Development, Economic Growth, Social Change and Ideas is also out now and is published by Oxford University Press. It is 10:30 on BBC Radio Oxford, and therefore time for a weather check.